welcome to the final program in the 2006 Fireside Chat Series. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School and moderator of the chats this year. The Fireside Chats are the signature online program of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, a nonprofit organization independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, which preserves and shares SEC and securities history through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The virtual museum, available free and worldwide 24/7, offers a growing collection of primary materials, including papers, photos, oral histories, and these online programs, on the impact that the SEC has had on national and international capital markets since its inception. The SEC Historical Society and the Virtual Museum receive no federal funding. We are grateful for the sustained support of Pfizer, Inc. as a continuing sponsor of the Fireside Chat Series. We're making a bit of history ourselves today in welcoming Professor Donald C. Langevoort, Thomas Aquinas Reynolds Professor of Law at Georgetown Law Center, as our panelist. Don launched the Fireside Chats back in 2004 and served as its first moderator. Don, I'm proud to follow in your footsteps. Our topic today is behavioral economics, looking at the links between psychology and economics and how cognitive and emotional processes influence our rational or irrational economic decisions. As a bit of background, I'll share this quote from the Oral Histories interview with Matthew Fink, retired president of the Investment Company Institute, which is in the virtual museum. Mr. Fink said, "There's a field developed in the last several years which challenges the pure market folks, who say that the market will take care of everything. I'm talking about behavioral economics and that people don't always behave from the most efficient point of view, as argued by the pure market theorists." Before we begin our discussion, I would like to note the remarks made today are solely those of the speaker and are not representative of the society. Our speaker cannot give investment or legal advice. Don, welcome back.
Thank you.
I suppose it would be best to start with a bit of overview. Could you start us off with some background on just what behavioral economics is?
Well, as you said in the introduction, behavioral economics is taking psychology and what we understand about how people think and make judgments and behave and working it into economic decisions. So anything that an economist would be interested in and use the standard tools of economics, a behavioral economist would say, well, I think I may have a better theory about how human beings behave. Psychology teaches us something, and they'll change the predictions of human behavior accordingly.
Is it possible to specify exactly how it is different from traditional economic analysis?
It's a branch of the field, so it's part of economics. Economics simply tries to predict how human beings or firms behave in market settings, in economic exchange relationships. So this is simply saying we can't use the traditional notion that people are rational utility maximizers. Instead, we should take into account how real people behave. Psychologists can tell us a lot about that, and that becomes behavioral economics.
Can you describe in general terms just how it might be helpful in analyzing issues in the field of securities regulation?
All over the place, and perhaps one way to think about it, and the quote you gave from Matt Fink suggests this, is by comparing it to what it's not. Conventional orthodox economics, which has such a hold in the study of finance and the study of markets, predicts that people are rational utility maximizers, and they will confront choices in a very steely-eyed, unemotional, rational fashion. Out of that come all sorts of predictions that are relevant to securities regulation. For example, if you give a rational person a disclosure document, the rational person will probably read it, think about it, and take all that information into account in deciding whether to buy a share of stock or invest in a mutual fund. Most of us would say, well, wait a minute, that misses some of the things we observe in real life about how people buy mutual fund shares or shares of stock. A behavioralist might come in and say, there are problems we know about in human cognitive processing, information overload, for example. that if you give a 40-page document to somebody and say, you know, even assuming they read it, they will not be able to process all that information. Maybe psychologists can help us understand what they look at and what they ignore, at what point they become so overloaded that the quality of their decision-making becomes worse rather than better. Those are all the places where, you know, the core issue in securities regulation, the virtue of disclosure, can be affected by learning in behavioral economics.
Does that suggest that in 1933 Congress would have done better to consult the psychologists before it acted?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that probably if you sat down with Louis Brandeis or Ben Cohen or any of the people who were influential in the formation of the Securities Acts and the SEC, they were no fools. I suspect they were no strong believers in market efficiency. But the politics of the time were such that a disclosure form of federal-oriented form of federal regulation, as opposed to merit regulation, which had been so common among the states, was all that was going to work. And if you're going to build a system of disclosure regulation, maybe it's not a bad idea to buy into the illusion that people make use of disclosure in purely rational fashion. So I don't know what the drafters would have done differently.
Do you think that there has been occasion to tweak the disclosure system on the basis of the insights that you've described?
Yes, although it's been slow in coming. And behavioral economics and behavioral finance, which is the subject of the study of market behavior, from the insights in psychology, has been around since the late 1970s. That's when it really started flourishing as a field. It has grown rapidly since then. It's fair to say that the SEC paid less attention to these insights for a long time than they should have. I think many commission initiatives would have benefited from learning the state of the art on judgment and decision making. And it's partly political and partly institutional. Once you've built an agency around the notion that disclosure is good, disclosure works, I'm not sure the agency becomes particularly receptive to research and learning that says, well, sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes you have to consider other strategies for the protection of investors. It upsets the history and the philosophy a little bit too much. But to its credit, in the last decade or so, various offices in the commission have become interested, have begun to use the insights of behavioral economics. And I suspect over the next few years, that influence is going to grow.
In 2005, the SEC adopted some fairly sweeping reforms of the basic registration system under the 33 Act. Can you see any thumbprint of behavioral economics in those reforms?
That's not an area where you can see a very strong thumbprint. It does, indirectly, sure, in the sense that the system that was put in place in 1933 and hardened into a very severe regulatory structure governing what you can say and what you can't say during the period of time before the filing of the registration statement while you're waiting for SEC comments, was all based on the underlying idea, we need to wait to make sure potential investors get this thing called the prospectus so that they can read that and not be influenced by all these other messages that are flying through the air or being given to them in print. That was probably an unrealistic expectation from 1933 on. In that sense, I think the 2005 reforms are very realistic. They basically, they do many things, but I suppose the punchline for offering reform in 2005 was the notion access equals disclosure, that you can put the prospectus on a website, make sure people have access to it, are aware of where it is, and that's good enough. My guess is that's pretty consonant with what we know about investor decision making. They will take into account quite a few things. They may not access, many won't, but many threw away the prospectus too. So I think there is some realism there, but I wouldn't pick it as a shining example of behavioral economics at work.
It does seem to me that the people who are most likely to read the prospectuses would be the ones who are also more likely to be willing to push the button to access.
Exactly. In that sense, I would call it a modern realist approach to the public offering process. And what behavioral economics says more than anything else is get real. Don't imagine how people behave. Don't create idealized senses of how they should behave and assume that they do. But study, research, and try to figure out how they actually do behave.
You've indicated that there's been some progress, probably in academic circles, as far as acceptance of behavioral economics and some inroads at the SEC. How about Congress itself? Do you see behavioral economics economists showing up to testify?
Again, it may happen. It happened, I guess, perhaps somewhat dramatically in the aftermath of the various conflict of interest scandals involving the accounting profession, whether non-audit fees were corrupting the judgment and decision of auditors, securities analysts, same issue. And some of the initial responses were, it's a classic economics problem, that so long as you take away the financial incentives, for example, take audit firms largely out of the management consulting and other non-audit fee-generating business, the conflict disappears and we will get objective and pure advice out of the accountants. And Max Baserman, who teaches at Harvard Business School, who is a very well-known figure in behavioral economics, did testify both before the SEC as it was considering rulemaking, and if I recall, before Congress as well, saying, again, what we know about conflicts of interest and how they affect judgment and decision-making suggests it's a far, far deeper problem. And that merely taking away non-audit fees is never going to solve the problem. That people reason in a motivated fashion so long as the nature of the audit remains in the hands of management, auditors will consciously or subconsciously adjust their perceptions to be in accord with what management wants. You're going to get biased judgments even. So in that sense, there are people offering this kind of advice to Congress, this kind of advice to the SEC. But again, let's be politically honest. It is hard to sit in front of Congress or the SEC and make predictions about human behavior that might be very realistic, for which you can't put on the table hardcore evidence. We know this to be true. And one of the problems with behavioral economics and behavioral finance is it's fairly infant in its development. The field is growing. We're starting to learn. We're starting to develop theories of human behavior. They aren't there yet. And so the best, really, from a public policymaking perspective, that behavioral economists can do is come and say, wait, be cautious here. We're starting to discover some things that suggest your policy won't work. We can't tell you it won't. We don't know enough yet. Hopefully, as our field develops, we will be able to tell you that. But right now, it's that cautionary note that they're most useful for.
So whereas traditional economics has a baseline assumption of bounded rationality, behavioral economics doesn't necessarily have something to substitute. Is that correct?
The holy grail is that substitution. And there are behavioral economists staying up 20 hours a day trying to find it. But right now, what you realize, and this is common sense intuition, that we non-psychologists, non-economists could come up with on our own is that, you know, human life is so rich and diverse that most judgment and decision-making is highly contingent. It depends on what's around us, who's around us, what our mood may be. There are hundreds of factors that are going to vary from person to person, even within a person from time to time. So making this grand prediction like orthodox economics makes, people maximize utility in a rational fashion, psychology would tell you that we can never do anything as simple as that. Life is complicated. People are complicated. So we can't give you nice, easy punchlines. But of course, what you hope you can come up with through this kind of research is, if not nice, easy punchlines, at least generalizations about behavior in economic settings, what lots of people are likely to do in similar situations that the SEC can use, that Congress can use in formulating rules and regulations.
What types of, it sounds as though there haven't been a tremendous number of empirical studies developed, but that people are attempting empirical study on these matters. Can you describe any of the studies?
Sure. There are lots of such studies. The problem is they generate results that are not easy to understand or that fix their way nicely into easy prediction. Let me give you one of my favorite studies that I think illustrates both how behavioral economics is done as a discipline, what its potential is, and the way it could really translate usefully into policy. At Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, one of the leading researchers in behavioral economics took a large number of MBA students and executive MBA students. In other words, people who have been out in the business world. One of the criticisms of psychology research is you have to get subjects into the laboratory, and it's hard to get successful, busy professionals into the laboratory to study them. But MBA students provide as close a substitute as you can get, because they've usually had some experience, and they have a good bit of training in finance. And they basically had them be mutual fund investors over a period of time, using computer simulations in changes in the markets. For every 5 minutes, the person could rebalance the portfolio. And what they were assigned to do, the protocol here, was we want you to tell us from time to time, just report on how you've done so far, and tell us how you're likely to do with the next set of moves. And of course, this can all be tested. Most of the subjects thought the main interests of the researchers were, how are you going to do in the future? And that was part of it. Would people be overconfident in their ability to make good mutual fund decisions? Yes, they were highly overconfident. Their predictions were systematically greater than their actual performance as the computer measured it. The more interesting insight, though, that was generated by this research was on the basic question: when you ask these people simply to report on how they've done, which is historically measurable, they had this information very accessibly in front of them, they systematically overstated how they'd done. They thought they had done better than they actually had. That's immensely important in understanding how people make investment decisions for retirement savings, for any number of things that are very important. If people don't realize that they haven't done as well as they want to do, it's self-deception. It's not admitting to yourself the truth. That's a big baseline in terms of, well, what good is various forms of disclosure or investor education or anything else likely to do? So that's a nice example of how this research actually plays out.
And it seems to me to be startlingly similar to the results on how people tend to underestimate the number of calories that they consume
in
a given day.
It is. And you know, an interest of mine in research, and I've studied investors and stockbrokers and various others is human capacity for self-deception. And yes, we all engage in self-deception. But economists tend to think that stuff disappears in markets where there are real stakes. Markets wash out biases like flattering yourself. And, you know, a study like this is, no, it doesn't. Very unlikely. And in fact, many behavioral finance people suggest what the markets do sometimes is amplify biases rather than wash them out.
Quite fascinating. We have touched on the use of these possible uses of the theories by the SEC and Congress. How about the courts? Are we seeing any impact?
Again, not directly in the sense that the results of the literature itself would inform a judge, at least not such that the judge would tell us. You can't read too many judicial opinions and find behavioral finance or behavioral economics right there. Again, however, at this stage of the development of behavioral finance and behavioral economics, its main contribution has been to undermine the faith we used to have in efficiency. In the 1970s, 1980s, courts did embrace market efficiency rather strongly, the notion that at any time the market price of a stock is the rational expectations of intelligent investors. That's one formulation of what's called fundamental efficiency. And lawyers, law professors, and many judges thought, hey, that's right, and important things followed from that, the fraud on the market theory for litigation. What behavioral finance has done is said, not so fast. We're learning things about how markets move, about how they adjust, that lead us to believe that that instantaneous incorporation of all relevant news may not be accurate. We are seeing, in a few cases, courts backing off strong efficiency statements. And you have to attribute that to this research that undermines the strong faith in market efficiency. That's been its impact on the judiciary so far. But it's small. And again, if you go back to what I said before about this, unlike the neat, easy punchline of orthodox economics, people maximize utility in a rational fashion, and substitute for it the complexity, the richness, the highly situated nature of social judgment and cognition, judges aren't going to be able to use that as easily as they could an easy punchline.
In your discussion just now, you raised the subject of the fraud on the market litigation. Could you follow up on that just a little bit and tell us a little bit more about what that is and about how you as a theoretician might...
Sure, and this is probably example number one of the importance of both economics and new waves of economic research as it relates to securities law. Because in the 1970s and 1980s, as belief in market efficiency grew, one of the lessons supposedly taught by that was the notion that what all reasonable investors do is realize they can't beat the market. That what you ought to do, don't pay attention to disclosure documents. The professionals are doing that. Disclosure is important, but let the professionals do that, the people who can actually make money in the market. All we, the rest of us, should be doing is relying on the market price as an indicator of the value of the company and expecting normal returns. We can't beat the market. Just invest in a diversified fashion, and that's the best you can do. Now, that was a normative statement. That's what we should do. And there's lots of evidence that individuals can't beat the market. That I'm
convinced.
Yeah, very few people would say the evidence is strongly in the other direction. But what academics and courts did is turn that into a legal presumption that people in fact rely on the market price as an indicator of fair value without thinking further. That insight led to an important rule in securities litigation, which is the class of persons who can bring suit for fraud and misrepresentation includes not only the people who actually relied on the misrepresentation, but anybody who bought into the market, because we presume all those people were doing the rational, smart thing. And so when the Supreme Court in Basic Inc. versus Levinson endorsed this fraud on the market theory, it cited the efficient market hypothesis, conventional orthodox economics, as the justification for it. Research since then has said that's not descriptively right, and it may not even be a good descriptor of the markets themselves. It's not descriptively right in the sense that most investors think they're going to beat the market when they buy and sell stock. That's why they pick. When you read mutual fund advertising, it's we're very good at stock picking. That's why you pay us management fees. When you invest yourself, and we know this from day trader behavior and lots of other studies, these are people who think they can beat the market. As we're learning more and more about how people actually make their decisions, we realize how artificial that assumption was that the Supreme Court bought into. Secondly, it's not entirely clear, in fact it's highly contestable, that markets really do instantaneously adjust in a rational fashion to all new information, so that it's even something worth assuming to be true. Markets drift, markets overreact, markets correct. Psychology does enter into the market, which undermines the theory behind the efficient market, behind the fraud on the market theory even more. So today, if you ask the question, should we have a presumption that everyone who bought during the period of the time of fraud is presumed to rely because that's what rational people do and we can presume that people are rational, you'd have to say no, not on that theory. Now, you might justify fraud on the market on deterrence grounds, on grounds that, you know, it's the only practicable way of case management. You don't want to have individualized reliance inquiries with respect to that would break down the whole system of private securities litigation, and if you think that system has value, the theory, the presumption may be worth saving, but not on the theory that the Supreme Court justified it back in the 1980s. The problem, of course, is having justified it in that way, having said this is tied to efficient market thinking, courts very quickly came to the conclusion, well, that means the presumption only applies when it's an efficient market. And today, many litigators are going into court saying, well, here, look at all this behavioral finance. Look at all the stuff we know about companies like this. There's no efficiency here. There's not. Look at these gyrations that you couldn't explain by anything else. So, court, don't buy into this notion that this class should be certified on fraud on the market grounds. And so courts really are forced to confront this theory, which the Supreme Court endorsed. And the question is, do they really understand why that theory doesn't have the support today that it had 20 years ago?
Somehow this whole subject seems to me to be quite easily related to the subject of irrational exuberance.
Oh, yes.
And do you think that the existence of what at least some people feel was a documented instance of irrational exuberance have contributed to the progress of behavioral economics?
Sure. If you go back a little bit of the history of behavioral finance, which is behavioral economics taken directly to the world of stocks and bonds. Go outside of the world of academics and talk, go onto Wall Street and ask, does psychology matter in the markets? The answer is, of course. And people like David Draymond, a mutual fund money manager, wrote books in the 1970s on the psychology of markets. And what he would point to, what everybody at the time would point to, is you see bubbles all the time. You see a company whose stock price goes up, not because of fraud necessarily, but because investors fall in love with it, and then it pops without any fundamental information justifying that radical a departure. Aren't bubbles the perfect indication that psychology is right and orthodox economics is wrong? So that was the going-in proposition for many people. Academics resisted that for a long time. But in the early 80s, some economists, taking advantage of the psychology literature to some extent, started saying, well, maybe bubbles are a real phenomenon. And maybe you can have asset bubbles that are inconsistent with market efficiency, but predictable, because we observe them so often. And the study of that, why did, let's look at particular bubbles. Why did they occur? What do we know about them? Actually generated much of the early interest in behavioral finance. So bubble study is associated with the growth of behavioral finance. It has since the beginning. Irrational exuberance, of course, is a phrase from the mid-1990s. Alan Greenspan used it in cautioning investors as the market was on its way up that prices seemed to be losing touch with fundamentals. And it was a way of saying, hey, this is psychology, this is animal spirits, rather than real. And one of the leaders in behavioral finance, Robert Shiller, who teaches it at Yale, wrote a book called Irrational Exuberance, basically saying, here are the reasons, here's the behavioral economics and behavioral finance that you need to know to understand that bubbles do happen, that exuberance often is irrational, that conventional economics doesn't explain this stuff all that well.
Speaking of animal spirits, one of your articles was about using behavioral economics to tame the animal spirits of the stock market. Could you hum a few bars from that article?
Well, I'm not going to hum anything. First of all, the phrase animal spirits is John Maynard Keynes. He used it in the 1930s. And if you wanted to do a true history of behavioral economics and behavioral finance, you go way back before the 1970s. And Keynes was very influential. Keynes is famous for saying stock markets are like beautiful baby contests, where people aren't guessing what the true value of the stock is. They're guessing what other people will think the true value of the stock is, which is an infinite regression as you try to imagine what everyone is going to say about that subject. It is predicting human behavior. So I picked up on that title because I think it captured the notion very well. To write an article about what we've been talking about this afternoon, which is what should securities regulation, what should the SEC and Congress and courts learn from this literature as we know it? And my going-in proposition, and I think I was properly cautious on this, echoes something I said before, which is we don't yet have a grand theory of behavioral finance or behavioral economics. You can't make confident, bold predictions about human behavior off of what we have so far. Rather, what we ought to do is take what we know from behavioral finance and behavioral economics and see if it helps us understand why things don't work as rationally as the conventional accounts might tell us, and how we might want to tweak regulation or adjust regulation accordingly. So I looked at a series of issues, the fraud on the market theory being one, where I thought maybe being more psychologically sophisticated could help. One of the topics I got into, and it's a favorite in the world of behavioral economics, deals with day traders and internet-based fraud. At about the time I started writing the article, the SEC brought its fairly well-publicized case against Jonathan Lebed, a young teenager in New Jersey, who created postings all around the internet saying, "I found the next stock to double in 36 hours. Here it is." His fingerprints were all over the place. And it seemed, if you looked at the evidence, that shortly after he would do these postings, the price would indeed go up. And the SEC had evidence that Jonathan, being a smart teenager, was investing in these companies, doing the postings, watching the stock price go up, unloading very quickly. And then, of course, because there's no sustained news or information there, within a few hours or a few days, the price would collapse again. Jonathan would get rich. Nobody else did. And so when the SEC found out about him, they brought a fraud case against him. Classic fraud and manipulation. And the question that is interesting to struggle with is, why did what Jonathan did, why did his plan work? And that was the fraud case. Because if it's brought as a classic fraud case, the SEC would be required to show that Jonathan made a material misrepresentation of fact with scienter in a way that induced the kind of behavior that generated losses for investors. Materiality. What did he say that a reasonable investor would likely consider significant? An anonymous posting on the internet saying, I know the next stock to double, strains credulity that anybody with half an ounce of intelligence would ever take that into account and say, gee, Jonathan is telling me I ought to buy. I guess I will. That's a fool. So actually, had it been litigated, Jonathan would have had a perfectly good defense to raise on materiality grounds, on reasonable reliance, on any number of things. So I set to tell a story about Jonathan and the law that didn't buy into the notion that he made a material misrepresentation that many people fell for. Because we know a lot about internet day traders, internet investors. They're not that stupid. They may be overconfident. They may be subject to any number of biases, but actually have greater financial knowledge than the average investor. I don't think you could posit that the average day trader, average in-and-out investor, really believed that Jonathan was making a statement of fact on which they then relied. The approach, however, that I took is, my guess is Jonathan suckered them. Not lied to them, but suckered them. That if you assume one of the major findings in the behavioral literature, that investors are largely overconfident in their ability to control their circumstances, and that, from a lot of study, we know pretty well, and it applies very strongly with respect to online traders, that what Jonathan was really taking advantage of was something like teenagers drag racing. He was basically blowing the whistle saying, let's play a game. Let's see who can win this game, get in first and get in out before everybody else does. And if you imagine that day traders, online traders out there are overconfident in their ability to do that, they'll play that game. Well, what happens when lots of them decide they play that game, even though only a few can win? The price goes up. What happens when they've ceased doing that? The price collapses. Nobody's been fooled. The only thing that's happened is these traders have clustered around Jonathan as if he's blowing the whistle on a game. He's starting the drag race. I think that's a better explanation, a more likely explanation for why the price goes up after Jonathan posts these silly little postings. He's just starting a brief game that fools are rushing in because they think they can win it, not because they've been deceived. So I made the point in the article. I thought the SEC ought to bring a case against him, but call it manipulation. Say that in behavioral finance says anytime you intentionally try to use psychological tricks to destabilize the market, to cause a frenzy, where indeed the frenzy ensues, you're doing something that the securities laws since 1933 have abhorred, and that is you are manipulating the market. So this would be an example of a more psychologically sophisticated look at a real phenomenon of concern to the SEC, a real case that the SEC brought, where I think, you know, when you bring that knowledge to bear, you might actually come up with a better understanding of what went on.
But still a way to deal with it, as you helpfully pointed out.
Yes, absolutely. Again, there's a debate that goes on among people in this field about what are the regulatory implications of behavioral economics. Do they point to the need for more regulation or less? The answer is they don't point clearly in either direction. They do teach you that some regulation, like disclosure, that we for 75 years have believed really works well, doesn't work as well as we think. On the other hand, once we take a more realistic view of behavior, then notions like, you know, you got to police the markets. The markets do need to be fair, become more compelling, and you need to come up with new original strategies for dealing with it.
So not more or less, but perhaps different.
Different, absolutely.
I think that I've heard something lately about an NASD study of senior citizen fraud that has drawn on behavioral economic insights. Is that?
Yeah, it's a very good example of using sophistication in psychology to help illuminate important areas in securities regulation. The NASD and the AARP have both been interested in fraud on senior citizens, not fraud by senior citizens. Because when you're living on a fixed income, a fixed portfolio, the devastating impact the impact of fraud is that much more devastating. So to their credit, both have invested in research on why does this fraud work? What do we know? And they retained a psychologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, I believe, who did this study looking at actual tapes or scripts that were uncovered during various NASD and SEC investigations into con artists who prey on senior citizens in particular. And he basically said, I'm going to take my knowledge of psychology and look at these, and I'll tell you why they work and what you ought to target. The thought, by the way, was this can be of use not so much in NASD enforcement as NASD investor education. The more we understand about why these pitches work, why these con games work from a psychological perspective, the better we can do at designing good education programs for investors. Lots of different findings that resonate in the psychological literature. The one that I found most intriguing was the following. If you take the group of senior citizens who were victimized by securities fraud and take a control group of senior citizens similar in all other respects that hadn't been victimized by fraud and give them a test, basic financial knowledge, what would you discover? Now, everyone's prediction would be these were the less sophisticated, less knowledgeable. They found the exact opposite, that in fact the group most easily victimized scored higher on their knowledge of basic financial tools, terms, techniques than the group that didn't get victimized. That's a stunner from the standard rational perspective. But the psychologist said, I'm not surprised. In fact, to a con artist, the person who thinks he or she knows something but don't realize that they don't know enough is the best mark, the best victim. You can actually take advantage of people's confidence. And basically what the study says is the best thing you can do to avoid being disadvantaged by fraud is hang up the phone before the pitch starts. And people who know they don't know anything about finance tend to do that. They don't want to get into this discussion with some sophisticated, smooth-talking person on the other end of the phone. The people who have some knowledge, some self-confidence, I'll listen. This guy isn't going to trick me. I know too much. And, of course, that's exactly what the con artist likes. Pick up on various little traits you have, ego, greed, and start moving the conversation in a direction that it starts punching the hot buttons that the person has indicated that he or she has. Another finding in the study, which relates to some work I've done in other areas, is many of the victims, a surprisingly large number of the victims of fraud, had within the last year suffered a negative life event, a divorce, the death of someone in the family, loss of a job, not one that would be devastating financially, but devastating emotionally. And the thought was that person, too, is a pretty easy mark. They believe life owes them something. And when the person dials the phone, when the phone rings and they pick it up and somebody is there offering them this special opportunity to get rich really quickly, it subconsciously triggers, I deserve this. They stay on the phone, and again, the skilled con man can take advantage of that. So I thought the NASD study really was useful in taking a lot of psychological sophistication and taking it right into the world of securities regulation. Why do cons work? Why do these schemes, the boiler room operations, and things like that work so easily?
Yes, indeed. And it does seem to have some very interesting signposts as far as what the shape of investor education might look like. It doesn't seem as though providing people with starter financial tools is the way to go.
No, and again, it may do more harm than good if you do only rudimentary financial education. You may leave people with the illusion that they actually can protect themselves when they can't. Little knowledge is a dangerous thing. There is no doubt that investor education and various strategies that are becoming more and more important to the SEC and the NASD need to take things like this into account.
It certainly seems as though a just say no education strategy with respect to those unsolicited phone calls might be very prudent.
Sure, and even just as prudent would be, at very least, when you are doing investor education, you've got to show fraud at work. You can't just say, learn to protect yourself, become more educated. You got to show how insidious it is, how it really does get into the subconscious of people who spend too much time on the phone, who subtly reveal cues that the con artist can take advantage of. That kind of education can be helpful. And you're right. The bottom line for that is hang up the phone.
Were there any animations in those studies that seniors' thinking processes were, in fact, different than anyone else's? Or that it was
no.
They were worried about
every one of these, and this is commented on, seems unrelated to being a senior citizen, with the exception of the negative life event, which might be the loss of a spouse, something like that, might be somewhat more predictable as people age. But everything else is just out of the con man's playbook that has been used against a wide variety of the population for a long time.
We've been focusing mostly on securities regulation, and I think properly so, but we have a few minutes in which I'd like to turn to the subject of behavioral economics and its possible implications for the field of corporate governance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about how or any examples of instances in which you think behavioral economics can gainfully be employed there?
Sure, and this is another big field. In corporate governance, the data isn't quite as good as with respect to stock price data. And it's harder to study with a high degree of statistical rigor in the governance field. That notwithstanding, let me give you a couple examples of places where you might take this knowledge and draw important things from a corporate governance perspective. First of all, we do know, I think this is probably fairly well established, that to the extent that markets are not efficient, they do tend to ride in waves. There are booms and busts in the stock market that may reflect investor appetite, investor psychology, as much as underlying economic conditions. What you would then guess is merger activity, initial public offerings, various financing activity will occur when managers believe that they're on the upswing rather than the downswing. And that has all sorts of implications for policymaking with respect to corporate takeovers, mergers, things like that. If basically what corporate takeovers are about is not disciplining inefficient management, but just cherry-picking when the market price has been inflated up for your stock or depressed for the targets, then your conclusions about the virtues of corporate takeovers, which is a big issue in corporate governance, change considerably. We also, and this, you can call this behavioral economics, it may start shading into organizational behavior and social psychology, but I think we gain a much richer understanding of, for example, independent director behavior or board of director behavior generally, if we think of directors not as rational overseers, but human beings who are subject to the same kinds of biases and heuristics that the rest of the world is, that they are motivated to see certain things and ignore certain things, that they will treat salient information differently from subtle information. You know, all the things that we learn about how people process information is relevant to the question, how well do we think X will do in monitoring the CEO from the standpoint of corporate governance? So there's been a big growth in the field of using psychology, using group dynamics to understand boards of directors in ways that I think are more sophisticated than simply treating them as the rational overseers of the company.
I was wondering if it might also have implications as far as the goals, perceived goals of shareholders are concerned.
Sure. There's no doubt that in a world where markets are efficient and investors are rational, you would expect the stock price, and this is the efficient market hypothesis, to be a rational reflection of value. And if you then said to corporate directors or corporate managers, your job is to maximize share price, it would not be a foolish goal to ask them to pursue. If you say that we can have bubbles, we can have waves in stock prices, that irrational exuberance can take hold in a company like Enron and push its market value up higher than the fundamentals would have justified, then a rule that says, directors, your job is to maximize share price, becomes ridiculous. What you're saying is, feed the fools. Share price maximization as a proxy, as our best estimate for what the goal should be, works very nicely in the efficient markets world. Behavioral economists would caution against making share price at any given time the be-all and end-all for the normative role of the company and its management.
I thought it might also have implications as far as perhaps questioning assumptions that all shareholders want from a corporation is a monetary return as opposed to clean air and less child labor.
Right. I don't know that behavioral economics, as the field has worked its way out, which is about judgment and decision making in economic settings, itself tells us that much about the other preferences that shareholders might have. We've known for a long time that shareholders have a great diversity of preferences in terms of what they want the company to be doing. Behavioral economics has, and we ought to be clear about this, another research area is, do people value fairness to others and those kinds of things strongly in their economic decisions? And the evidence is yes. Now, you can certainly take that and say that's an indicator that we shouldn't assume that investors are only interested in a buck, especially a short-term buck. So there is promise to take that research, but it doesn't take us all that far.
We're getting close to the end. I was wondering if you had any articles or books that you might recommend to listeners for basic reading in the field.
There are two good books by academics on behavioral finance and behavioral economics relating specifically to stocks and bonds, to the world of securities. One is by Andre Schleifer, S-H-L-E-I-F-E-R, at Harvard, called Inefficient Markets. Another, Robert Shiller, I mentioned before, at Yale, who's very well known for his book called Irrational Exuberance, which is also a very nice treatment of the developments in this field. And I've long been a fan of David Draiman, who deserves a lot of credit for, in the 1970s, sticking to the notion that you can be a contrarian investor, that psychology teaches you bet against all that so-called smart money. And he's written a book called Contrarian Investment Strategies, which is, to some extent, for real investors, a Bible in integrating psychology into their thinking.
Well, I knew that you'd be far too modest to mention any of your own writings on the subject, but I would definitely recommend them to our listeners. Don, thank you for this discussion of behavioral economics. It was very illuminating. Thank you also for making possible the successful launch of this series of online programs. Since 2004, the Fireside Chats have covered a wide variety of topics, from municipal securities and state securities regulation to online fraud to executive compensation and cross-border regulation, all archived in the virtual museum and visited again by our listeners. I'm going to boast on behalf of Don and myself that our audience to date, both live and repeat, is over 8,700 persons. Today's Fireside Chat is now archived in the virtual museum by audio tape. A transcript will be added later. This is the close of our 2006 series, but we'll be back in spring 2007. I, as moderator and Pfizer Inc. as sponsor, with a series of discussions of legislation, Congress, and the courts as they impact securities regulation. Please continue to visit www.sechistorical.org for updated information on chats and broadcast dates and times. Thank you again for being with us today.